Thank you very much. I begin to wonder who he was talking about. First of all, I want to thank the committee for making it possible for me to be here, inviting me to take part in this program. This is the first program of this particular 11th Step Retreat. I was privileged to speak on the first program of the Camp Monroe Retreat. And that's why I certainly get a charge out of doing these things. I have enjoyed this retreat thus far, as you probably have. That may change at any moment. I was thinking about some of the talks I heard up to this time, and there's some pretty difficult people to follow. But everyone has his own story and his own experiences and his own way of putting them across. I know in AA we hear a lot about miracles. And I always like to talk about the miracle of AA. You heard something about miracles just a few moments ago from our visitors from the penal institution. These people who are in such position and they catch fire with a desire for betterment and do something about it and continue to do something about it in the face of seeming hopelessness, this is miraculous. I think that every person here, every alcoholic and every other person who belongs to an alcoholic or is associated with one in any form, I think perhaps he's been touched by miracles. I know that my entrance to this fellowship is nothing short of miraculous. I've often told this story. The way I got to AA, I came to a fellowship that was not in existence, became a member of something that wasn't going even. The mathematical chances of my ever being associated with this fellowship were practically nil. I was something like one of the speakers last night, our old friend Julian. I was not a periodic drinker. I was a chronic drinker. I was drunk all the time. This was normal operating procedure for me. And I never did get into all this jazz about DTs and this because I never gave these things a chance. I had the medicine to keep them away. Only these people had made it so tough on themselves used to get these kind of activities. But I was a chronic alcoholic. And it was normal, as I said, for me to be drunk. I wound up a bump. And I mean a bump. I worked myself out of a position where I could even work. Julian was making a short trip to work last night. I go along with him in a lot of his work business, but to go to the place, as far as I was concerned, it wasn't by my choice at all. I became absolutely unemployable. I've often told a story about how I couldn't even get on WPA. And brother, there is nothing more unemployable than that. I also mentioned one time about the fact that my ex-wife had a big interest in my going to work, naturally. And she happened to be the head of a men's department in an employment bureau. And she couldn't get me a job. So I would say that as far as employment was concerned, I was about at the bottom of the barrel. I wound up on the bum. And my last crash dive into this resulted in my winding up in New York City. My brother-in-law took me there on his truck. Ostensibly, this is my last chance to be able to stay home and live a respectable life. This was predicated upon the idea I could go to work for him. And I accepted the challenge. Not without some reluctance, however, but I accepted it. So, I got drunk on him before we ever got to New York. When we got to New York, he dumped me out on the waterfront and left me there. I can't tell you how long I stayed in New York. but I was there a long time. I did not lie around in the Bowery, New York. I found something better to my liking. I got myself the first gainful employment I had had in many a long day. And this gainful employment consisted of this. There were a lot of truck drivers used to drive their trucks into New York, and they parked their tractors there under this overpass down by the Kennard steamship lines down that district. And they would go get a hotel room someplace for the night or so. They had to wait to get a return load back. These fellows employed me as a watchman. A truck driver gave me 50 cents a night to watch his tractor. With this 50 cents, I was in business. See, I was paying 7 cents a pint for my booze. I bought it in a wallpaper store. And with this 50 cents, I couldn't drink that much booze. It was impossible. So I saved money. I became a capitalist. I didn't have to eat. I didn't pay anything for eating, rather. I found out how to eat for free. I didn't have to buy any clothes. I had no taxes to pay. I had no old lady on my back. I had no troubles. I had no creditors. I had it made. And I was saving money. That was my condition. But then when I landed in New York, I had tried to get in the good graces of a sister-in-law of mine in Yonkers. And she picked me up and took me right back down at the waterfront and threw me out where her brother had thrown me previously. But this gal, sometime later, had the doctor over for her youngsters. And they got to talking about drinking. And she told the doctor about the experience she had with this drunken brother-in-law of hers, who used to be a nice guy, but now is nothing but a drunken bump. He says, you know, that God, I had a brother-in-law like that who was a drunk, too. And he met a group of men who spend all their time trying to fix drunks. And this fella hasn't had a drink for quite some time. And he says, furthermore, there's a doctor who seems to be in cahoots with him. This doctor is over in Akron, Ohio. And he spends all of his time fixing drugs. And if your brother-in-law here should get back to Ohio, maybe he can get down there to Akron and meet this doctor. Maybe this doctor can fix him. I don't know this is going on, of course. I'm tending to my business down in the Well, eventually, like all of us, we head for home. Why, God only knows, but we head for home. There was nothing there to head for, but I headed for there. And I got there eventually. One trucker took me to Erie, I remember that, and I hit the right in from there to Cleveland. I tried to get in the nest, and the little woman met me at the door. And I didn't get in, of course, but she did tell me about this doctor and asked me if I'd like to go down and see him. So I had nothing to lose. And I wanted to quit drinking for a long time before this, but I was unable to. So she brought me a one-way bus ticket to Akron, Ohio, and put me on the bus and sent me. And that's how I met my sponsor, Dr. Bob. She put me in Akron City Hospital eventually, and I sobered up there, and the last drink I had was February 11th, 1938. And I have been sober to this day. Now, I had quite an experience there. This is, you heard a few moments ago, used to be the Oxford movement. They did things a lot differently in those days than they do now. But be that as it may, they didn't suggest anything to me. They told me what I had to do. And I'm sure glad they did. This idea of giving drunks a choice as to what they want to do and take a choice between this and that and do this any way you want to. To me, this is a lot of hogwash. It'll never work. If you give a drunk a choice, he'll always pick the wrong one. He's always looking for the easy way out. There's a price to this, and we must pay it. There's something we have to do. We don't come in here and get hypnotized, nor do we get well just by rubbing elbows with a lot of other drunks who happen to be sober for a while. It don't work this way. There's a way of doing it. They taught me about this in Akron, Ohio. Okay, so much for that. I'm not going into any more of that story. Because some people have asked me to relate a couple other things. They wanted to, that some of them heard, and they wanted me to relate again. We sit around sometimes reminiscing about things and talking about some experiences and experiences with some of the characters we have met over the years. Believe me, I'm not talking about the good old days, because some of those days were not too good back there many years ago in AA circles. But I'll tell you one thing, sure, we used to meet some more interesting drunks then than we ever find today. We met a bunch of monkeys there in those days who were really ready, and they knew it as well as everybody else did. And we really met some characters. And no inroads had been made yet as far as straightening any of them up, so the world was our oyster. We had plenty of people to play with and plenty of people to experiment with. Way back, about 1939, the Cleveland Plain Dealer ran a series of articles about AA. We had started our movement up in Cleveland as AA, and they ran these articles. And we were deluged with responses. Everyone seemed was writing us and wanting some help for somebody. A few drunks even wrote in. This is unusual. But usually these drunks we found couldn't even write anymore. And none of them read newspapers. They used newspapers to make nests with. And that's about the use they had for them. Now, anyway, as time went on, a lot of judges, social workers, police, ministers, priests, men of the cloth, doctors, and what have you, they got interested in this idea about these AAs sobering up. A lot of people were starting to get off the streets that used to be laying in them. And people missed them. And they found out that some of these birds are sober. A good many people are sobered up. So some of these social workers got busy, and one of them, I want to tell you the story about her, what she did to me. This social worker would not be denied. She was a big gal, and her name was Mooney. She was big, and she was Irish. And she had some little Irish chum named Catherine that she was interested in. And she got on my back about Catherine. She insisted that Catherine was the only gal in the world that amounted to anything or should amount to anything. And she's going to see to it that I fix Catherine. Well, she sure stuck with it. Every time I turn around, I'm getting in trouble from Mooney about Catherine. Catherine, I'll tell you something about her and her background. She came from very wealthy people. And she'd been educated abroad. She had wonderful opportunities at one time in her life. She's quite a gal. Catherine broke up one of her uncle's homes when she was 15 years old. She was a swinging gal. And at the time that I met Catherine, she was living with some Italian bootleggers in a colored neighborhood. And there was nothing, nothing but nothing that Catherine wouldn't do for a drink. And Catherine was quite a character. She spent a good deal of her life. In fact, I think she was spending a life sentence on the installment plan in the woman's workhouse at Warrensville. How many times she'd been out there, God only knows, but she knew every nook and cranny of this place. I think she took charge when she went out there. Anyway, Mooney thought that Catherine had possibilities, and this is a real challenge. So, poor old Catherine and poor old me. I had to work with her. Catherine, I finally got her sober enough to take her to a meeting, and the women threw her out. They wouldn't have her. I might say that Catherine was Irish, and she had all the mouth that goes with a good Irishman. She also was, she used to teach sailors how to swear. She was dirty, she was profane, she stumped, and she was really something. So I took her to this meeting, and we were meeting in a home at the time, and the women there would have no part of Catherine, so out she went. I mean, almost me with her. Well, Mooney wouldn't let me cut loose from her, so I had to do what I could with Catherine. I took her down to Akron to a few meetings, I took her to a few picnics and things like this. The chaplain would keep on getting drunk. So I'm walking down Euclid Avenue one day, down near 82nd and Euclid, in Cleveland, busy, nice, around noontime. All the people are coming out of the business places going to lunch. And here's Catherine coming down the street, and she's staggering all over the place, drunker than on paper. So I think I'm going to do a Boy Scout duty, take Catherine home. I don't want her to land in a sneezer again, so take her home. So I'm getting along all right for about a block or so. But Catherine decides she wants something to eat. Well, Catherine isn't in any condition to eat, but she thinks so. Now, that's a humor, so I think, all right, I'll run her in this Greek joint down here and get her a fat sandwich and get her home. But she won't have this Greek joint. Catherine has been raised better than that. Captain wants a plate with tablecloth. And here's the first big mistake I ever made with Captain. Outside of meeting her. I take her into this nice restaurant at 79th and Euclid, which is a spaghetti restaurant, and it had rugs or carpets on the floor, and they had waiters there with tuxedos. And I waltz her in there at high noon, and all these business people are in there. It's a nice, quiet, refined place. And she shouldn't. She just don't belong. She thought so. So Catherine, as I say, she's dirty, she's loud, she's profane, and she stinks. And she sits down, and a waiter comes over, and then the trouble begins. And she starts giving an order, and he has something to say, and she don't like what he says, so she told him something about his ancestry, his family background. He don't like this either. So eventually he brought the food, and what she ordered was spaghetti. She had about as much type of ham and spaghetti as I have a flying one of these spaceships. But the spaghetti comes, and this waiter comes with it, and he gets some more lip from Catherine. And in the meantime, she's making a lot of noise, and she has everyone in the place disturbed. So everybody's on edge with her. So Catherine begins to eat her spaghetti. I mean, she tries. She's got it in her hair. Spaghetti. Well, all this ruckus, the head waiter comes over and tells her she'd have to quiet down or she has to leave. She don't like this. She likes him less than the waiter. She told him a few things. And he started to leave, and he changed his mind and came back. And he shouldn't have done this. Catherine did nothing but pick up that plate of spaghetti and bingo. She let him have it. Right on. Well, in about 2 minutes, the wagon was there, and Catherine and I are both in the wagon. And away we go. And now, try to explain a thing like this. I get in, there's all those dumb knuckleheads down there in the can. And I try and tell them I don't belong here. No, I mean, we know you don't belong here. Nobody does. So this goes on and on and on. I'm not guilty. Well, nobody in jail is guilty. Well, anyway, I find him, I'm screaming about this. You get a hold of Ed Crawley, the probation officer, and he'll explain the whole thing. So finally, sometime later in the afternoon, one of these knuckleheads broke down and decided he would call Crawley. And Crawley thought this was hilarious. And he came down, he got me out. But they kept Catherine. Didn't let her out. Well, sometime later, I guess Mooney arranged that Catherine only spent a couple days in the can, enough to get sobered up or something. Anyway, a few weeks later, I'm walking down Euclid again, same corner. I sit to the juke. I'll never forget this corner. The Unitarian Church is on one side and the Jewish temple is across the street. And a big traffic light. And Catherine is coming down the street again, and there she is as I run right into her. Drunk, oof, same condition. So I'm going to be a Boy Scout and get her off the street again, at least. So I tell her, Catherine, we're going home. We don't eat this time. So it's okay. We start for home. We start crossing that traffic light, and Catherine gets an idea. She feels it, call it nature.
Right in the middle of
the intersection. Thousands of people walking up and down there. And she squats. I stand there holding her hand. I was surprised in a few minutes the wagon hit again. Where it came from, I don't know. But people stopped, they interested passersby stopped. And they looked and they made remarks, and Catherine returned the compliment. So the next thing you know, we're in the wagon again. And away we go. Well, it's the same routine. I get down there, I'm in the same trouble again. It's a different bunch on this time. I'm a different crew on this afternoon. And I go through that same routine. They finally got Crowley again, and Crowley came down. He really thought this was great. I didn't. So he got me out, and they kept Catherine again. So here's the balance of this story. It seems funny now. It is funny. It wasn't funny then to me. It probably, to onlookers, it probably was. But this is quite tragic at the time. But I told Mooney, I said, this has got to cut out. This is getting monotonous. We can't keep this up anymore. We got to do something with Catherine. So we fixed her up. It was easy to fix Catherine. We arranged to give her a year. They gave her a year as a habitual in the woman's workhouse at Warrensville. And away she went. Well, Catherine, of course, knew that I had something to do with this, and so I dare not go out and see her. I'd get murdered. So I waited. Several weeks later, Catherine sent for me. The matron sent word that Catherine wanted to see me. So I was living in a lousy $10 a week boarding house at that time. We were talking about tonight. One of the ladies here knows a fellow who planted it. Came to that boarding house and got his indoctrination in AA there. And I was living in this joint, and I had no money. I was making $20 a week and paying 10 of it for room and board. And the rest of it, I had to take care of my clothes and squander on women and AA. And so I went to the dime store and did some shopping for Catherine before I went out to the workhouse. I bought her some gumdrops and some sink water and some powder and some cigarettes. I think I must have spent at least 60, 65 cents on it, which is a big deal. And the last of the big spenders. And so I take this out to see Catherine. That little blooming place is about 15, 20 miles out of town. So I went out there, and boy, oh boy, when Catherine was called to see me, boy, did she let loose. I heard things from Catherine that I never knew or ever, you know, she makes up words. But she had them, and I got them. But she finally ran out of gas, and I gave her my little peace offering, and she took it. She wanted to get out of there, so she wanted us out of there. I said, no, Catherine, you're not going to get out of here. You're in here for a year, and you're going to stay here for a year. You're not going to get out. Make up your mind. This is it. But once you're going to do something that you started out to do, you started out to do a year here and you're going to do it. Well, eventually she resigned herself to it. I went out to see Catherine every week. All times she's there. Most of the time, twice a week, I go out. Here. And Catherine, they put her in a hospital out there. And Catherine, actually, I think, had everything from dandruff to fallen arches and ingrown toenails and athlete's foot. She had it all. And it took them a long time to clean her up. They didn't have all these wonder drugs there, you know. But eventually they got her cleaned up, and Catherine was doing all right. And she was, I might say, the skinny of the match. She went out there. She was really emaciated. And they fattened her up, and she came out of there a year later, and Mooney got her a job as a lifeguard on one of the city beaches. And Catherine worked on that job all summer long until it's closed. Then she got her a job in one of the hotels as a room clerk. She'd pick up the keys as people went out. And Catherine worked on that job, and she started to take up her study of typing in shorthand. She'd done this once before, and so she got herself worked up on this. And you remember, Catherine got herself a job as a stenographer. Mooney didn't get this job. Catherine got this job. Mooney got the other two for her. She got a stenographic job. She worked at that. And eventually, she got promoted to a secretary. Catherine saved her money. Mooney had gotten her a nice place to stay when she came out with some police people way out of another part of town. They knew nothing about alcoholics or rummies or anything. And Catherine took an interest in young people's work in her church. She was a Catholic. And she went to work in a church. And she was good at this stuff. She really was. She was in a church. And she saved the money, and Catherine finally, eventually went into the real estate business and became a wealthy woman. She's now retired, living down in Florida as a story boy. Now, when I think of Catherine, I know that there isn't a person in the world who, if they have the proper attitude and given half a chance, can't make good on this program. Somebody comes around and gives me a lot of rebellion, but they hear from some of them, I think of Catherine. And then it gives me the courage to tell people what they can do and where they can go. That Catherine taught me a good many things. Now, Catherine never took up with AA. She didn't feel that she wanted to after the reception she got, but she's still a sober woman. She's as big as a house now, but she's sober and has had a successful life. Catherine learned the principles of how to live, and she applied them. What we, you and I here, learn. You know, coming to AA, anybody can get sober. It doesn't take any genius to become sober. But it takes something to stay that way. It takes a staying power. It takes doing something. I hear a lot of things in AA meetings about how you can do this program or how you can choose this and choose that and all this kind of crap. But believe me, this is not scripted as far as I'm concerned. I think there's a technique to this. I think there's a way to do it. And if a person doesn't do it according to the way it's prescribed, he may not get drunk, but he's going to miss an awful lot. The chances are most of them will get drunk. I can speak with authority on this because I have seen a good deal of this. The first 2 years and a half that I was in this fellowship, after we started in Cleveland, I must say, I've been in the fellowship some time when we started there, I kept record of people who came in, and I had the opportunity to keep records of people. I knew them all. All of them went through my hands to come in there. I found it to be an activity. So I got all the inquiries that came through to newspapers, anything, anywhere at all, from New York or any place. They all came to me first. So I had a good chance taking care and keeping records on people for quite some time until it got out of hand completely. So I can remember keeping records on several hundred people, and after 2 years and a half, 91% of them never had a drink. Remember that. Now, if any group can tie that or come close to it or come within 10% of it now, I'll kiss your foot. I'll eat your hat like they say on TV. Now, why is there a difference? People ask me this. Why? We were talking about this last night, a couple of us sitting around talking. Why? People get concerned. They should be concerned. For that very reason, that people come here and you give a drunk a choice of what he can do and tell him to make up his own program. This is suicide for a rummy. There's a program of 12 steps in AA, and these have all been written in the past tense, which indicates that someone has used them and done them, and it has been successful. I don't care what fellowship, what club, what lodge, what organization, or what church, or whatever you might want to join or align yourself with, there are certain things required of us. If you want to join the Masons, there are certain things you're supposed to attest to. If you want to join the KSC, you find something else. If you want to join the church, you have to stand for something. A fellow says if you don't stand for something, you're very apt to fall for most anything. So we have to stand for something. What we stand for in AA is this 12-step program. If we could have gotten by with 4 steps, 7 steps, 9 steps, or 11 steps, or what have you, we'd have gladly done it. We could have gotten by with two. But it took 12. And why did it take 12? I'll tell you why. I was here when these steps were written. I was in on the writing of these steps, and I know the purpose of them, and I know the origin of them, where they came from. These are nothing that we just dreamed up. There's a certain routine that these steps represent. The old Oxford movement used to talk about life changing. And this is a life changing process. As long as this world has been going on for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, as long as history is recorded, there has been alcoholics, and we've heard about them. They've been recorded in history, they've been recorded in the Bible, they've been recorded in ancient history. The first reference to anyone getting drunk in the Bible, you can look right in the first thread in Genesis and find out what happened to old Noah on the ark. Read that and see what happened to him. He really went on a real bust. Yeah. And there's plenty of other ones that this happened to. This is not yesterday. This is a long time ago. You read about things in ancient history, you read them all down through history, the exploits of alcoholics. You also read about efforts which were put into effect to try and curb alcoholism or overcome it. Or overcome the alcoholic, he's one of the three. And nothing ever was successful until the idea comes along that this is not just something that a person does because he's just a no good so and so. There's something wrong with an alcoholic, a person that's obsessed with this thing of alcoholism. And there's no way of fixing him without his whole life changing. So in the Oxford movement, the alcoholic was given the opportunity of having his life changed. And to change a person's life, there are certain things that have to be apparent. First of all, there has to be a need for a change. If a person's all right, he's perfect, nothing wrong with him, what should he change for? Let's go on through the same way we are. So obviously, any rummy certainly needs a change. He sure does. Our program has all the elements in it, which, if you will put them together and apply them, accept them, believe them, use them, your life will be changed. Now, we come to this fellowship. Why do we land here? I told you how I got here. How come I got here? How come you got here? Thousands and thousands of other people will never get here, and millions of people. People who walked across the face of this earth before we were ever on it lived, existed, and died in misery as alcoholics and carried a lot of their friends and family with them in this disgrace and misery. They never had this chance. You and I have a chance. You and I have been exposed to this. You and I are blessed. This is only by the grace of God that we have this. It isn't because we deserve it. Is there any rummy out here that deserves what he gets here? My heavens, the Betsy, you see a fellow walk into AA, just think about this for a minute. A guy walk in here, a gal, they're broke, they're penniless, they haven't got a home, they have no clothes, if their feet are on the ground, their hind ends out of their britches, they have no place to go, they're dirty, they think they're scared to death, hopeless. And they come in here, what happens? You see them, the same person, a few weeks later, you don't recognize him. He's altogether different. He's got patches on his breeches, or he's got a new pair. His bare feet aren't on the ground anymore. He's got some shoes that match. I used to have a brown one and a black one. I used to come and get shoes that match. You get maybe a coat that matches the pants, even. You get a little jingle in the pocket, get a job, and the best of all, you've inherited a lot of friends. And people here will pay attention to you and make a fuss over you. All the people before made a big fuss over you, all right? They want to get you out of the way. They want to avoid you. That's about the story. This changes. This happens all quickly with us. Now, who among us deserves this, and why do you get chosen, and why do I get chosen, and a lot of other people don't? To this is something we should ask ourselves. Whether we get the answer to it or not, I think that it behooves each and one of us to be very, very thankful. No matter what our circumstances happen to be, we should be most thankful that we are chosen for this opportunity. Now then, what we do with this opportunity, this is what's important. We're given this chance. When every person comes here, something happens to him. He's touched with something. He is touched. If he never gets faced over at all, something has happened to him. He never forgets the experience of having been exposed to AA. He just don't forget it. It'll even ruin his drinking for him, if nothing else. He's never the same, because he knows there is a way out. Now, I have learned many years ago in dealing with people coming to AA, as far as I personally am concerned, I know how to qualify a person in my sight as far as a person is concerned that I may be able to help. I don't know about some of you. Maybe you'll have to knock your brains out the way I did to learn this. But I know this. There have to be certain things apparent. When a person comes to this fellowship, if I'm going to have any kind of success with him at all in helping him to begin a new way of life and stay with it, effective change. First of all, a person must be an alcoholic, and he must admit it. Now, I didn't make this up. This all comes from the big book. Remember this. Second thing that I want to know about a fellow is, what does he want to do about it? There's a lot of alcoholics, and they'll admit they are, but they don't want to do anything about it. Some do. Okay, says he wants to quit. Okay, the big important thing now is, I ask him the next question. Okay, you're an alcoholic and you want to quit. Here's what that separates them. I ask this fellow, what are you willing to do? To quit drinking forever. What are you willing to do? To quit drinking forever. I understand I didn't say anything about quitting drinking for an hour or 24 hours or a day or anything else. I said forever. And that's exactly what I mean. I want to know how interested this fellow is. You hear a lot of funny answers to this. A lot of quibbling around sometimes. But I want this fellow to tell me he's willing to do anything to quit drinking forever. Where do I get the authority for that? Am I taking his inventory? What am I doing? I don't mind if I take his inventory. Who else is going to take it? Here's where I get the authority. Right in the fifth chapter of that book of ours, there's a sentence in there that's so important. And a lot of us overlook it or we don't hear it very well. It says in that fifth chapter, if you want what we have, and if you're willing to go to any length to get it, now you are ready to take certain steps. There's where the story comes for it. An alcoholic is a type of individual. People disagree with me on this. I believe this wholeheartedly. An alcoholic is a type. Everyone can't be an alcoholic. This is a privilege reserved for a chosen few. Believe me. And I think you can take an alcoholic and you can catalog him by characteristics. And I'll tell you a few of his characteristics. I've never seen an alcoholic yet who was not a high-strung individual. I've never seen one that didn't have a wealth of imagination. I've never seen one that wasn't an extremist. Never anything but halfway measures with a rummy. When he works hard, he plays hard, and when he gets drunk, he makes a career of it. He's an idealist. He sure is. And he's a very sensitive soul. He's always going around looking for someone to hurt his feelings. But he's sharp. He's a conniver. He's the biggest liar that ever wore shoes. And he'll steal anything, including a red-hot stove. If it has to be done, he'll do it. When it comes to the wherewithal to get that booze, if he has to do it, he'll do it. When the economic pinch gets down, he'll drink anything. I know there's a lot of people coming in here, since I have only drank themselves down to their second-last yacht. I know this. But nevertheless, if that other yacht sinks, or they lose it, and they lose their dough, they'll buy that 7-cent stuff, too, to keep drunk. It isn't a matter. You know, you don't think I drank that stuff because I liked it. Most rummies I know don't even like to taste the booze. Really. I'm a Dutchman. I enjoy beer. I can't say that I particularly enjoyed whiskey because I couldn't afford good whiskey. When you drink that garbage stuff that I drank, yeah, I was a guy that started drinking bootleg days. I couldn't afford to buy this fancy stuff. I had too big a gullet. So I drank rotten whiskey. You know, most of it was rotten anyway in those days. I drank rotten whiskey from the beginning. And even when whiskey came back, a short time it was back before I quit, I still didn't buy liquor store whiskey. In fact, they wouldn't let me in a liquor store. They've been in jails, they've been in sanitaries, they've been in hospitals, they swore off, they've been swore at, they've been sworn with. Everything has happened. We've made pledges, we've done everything. We've made promises. We tried everything. We tried being gentlemen drinkers, lady drinkers. We've been trying to drink just on Tuesdays, just on Saturdays. We tried just beer, we just tried something else, and nothing ever worked. We just said work. No matter how we tried, a lot of our efforts were real sincere. And we figured we were doing the right thing. We were trying to the best of our ability. We couldn't make it. I was in that squirrel cage. But I never could straighten out until something happened to my life. And this is how I straightened out. And this is how people get the benefit of AA. This is a life-changing program, as I mentioned, and here's how it does it. In order to change a person's life, there has to be certain things present. I told you before that there has to be a reason for it. And then we have to face the thing. We have to face the issue. You heard a speaker this morning talking about her hospital experiences, and she got to be one of these institutionally minded states. As soon as she got drunk, she wanted to go to that hospital, and then she didn't want to leave that hospital. See, she'd have lived the rest of her life in a hospital if she hadn't faced up to things and made a stand for something. This is how it happens to a lot of us. We may not get in the hospital, but we get in that jug. When something gets tough, we get in that jug. An alcoholic is afraid of pain, and he never, never wants to hurt too much. And the only time we're in really real trouble is when we're sober and drinking and sober. When we are passed out, we don't feel any pain. We're anesthetized. So the alcoholic, when things get real rough, he jumps in that jug and there's no problem because he's unconscious. He don't feel anything. He sticks pins in him. He don't know it. He has no bills. He has nobody to bother him. He has nothing when he's unconscious. But here we have to learn how to face life. So we... This program brings us face-to-face with it. So our first step, here's what our program is broken down into. It's in four phases, this program. The first phase of our program is admission. We admit that we are powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. If we don't admit that, we have no place to start. So that's the first phase. Second phase of our program runs from the second through the seventh step. I choose to call this the phase of submission. We have admission, now we have submission. These are the steps in which we submit our will and our life to the care of God. Listen how these read. Second step says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves should restore us to sanity. You heard a lot about sanity last night. Step two, you heard that referred to. That is talking about that second step. All through his talk, which is his theme last night about sanity. What right has any rummy to take umbrage about this sanity step? Of course you will. A lot of them say, well, I wasn't insane. Brother, when you're sober about 5 years and think about it, you'll be glad somebody will tell you you're nuts. Absolutely. I'm glad that somebody somebody told me I was nuts. Just let me out and let me off the hook. Some of the things I did, boy, if I wasn't nuts, they should have shot me. That's for sure. Okay. So we came to believe that power greater than ourselves to restore us to sanity. Why did I come to believe this? I came to believe this because of the inspiration of these men whom I met in that hospital, in Akron City Hospital, who came and visited me. Those fellows were real rummies. They were all older men than I was. And they had been down this path. And they told me the stories of their lives and what happened to them. They were sober. Some of them just a few weeks, some a few months, but they were sober. And I wanted to be one of them. And they told me a power to help them. So I wanted this power to help me. I wanted to believe it would help me. They told me it would, and I wanted to believe it. The power of example is what helped me, and I think it does a good many of us. That's why you and I all have responsibilities here, to be a little example of somebody coming in. Third step, it says here, we made a decision. Can you imagine running making a decision? Here's where we start separating the men from the boys. Now, remember, we have to do something in AA. We made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God. Now, that's asking an awful lot of a runner coming to AA. A fellow comes in here and he has lost all contact with God, willfully or otherwise, and he's probably scared to death of him and has very, very peculiar notions about who he may be. I've often discussed this with people. I probably discussed this thing about God with more people than a lot of ministers I know. And I get some funniest reactions from people what the picture of God is. And the kind of people we are, which I outlined a few moments ago by characters, we're like a bunch of kids we never had grown up, and I have never seen anybody grow up in AA yet either. We're always like a bunch of kids. And we're an emotional bunch, and we get moved very easily, and we live by emotion, and we live by feeling. And yet, some of these people coming in about God and what their conception of him is, you get some real funny pictures, real peculiar ones. They're not to be laughed at. This is very natural that we should be this way. But we have to get a conception. Now, here we're asked to make a decision to turn our will and our life over the care of this ethereal creature way out in the blue yonder here, whom we know a little bit and probably scared of and very suspicious of and probably think that we've probably been abused by. We're going to turn our will and our life over to this care of this creature. Believe me, if that little sentence in that third chapter isn't holding good with us, we're not about to do this. We're not going to do it. This is where the men and the boys start to separate in AA. This is where we start taking a stand. This is the first showing of faith and a little bit of guts. All right, suppose a fellow gets past that and gets into the fourth step. Says we need a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. A searching and fearless moral inventory. We want to find out what we have to work with. It's pretty difficult sometimes to find any moral fiber that's worth thinking with, but there's always something there. Believe me, there is. This doesn't mean we have to get up and call all about all the dirty, lousy things we've done all our lives. God knows most of us can't remember half the things we've done. But we have to find out what we have to work with. Searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And I might say at this point that I don't think there's worthy or name that's capable of taking that inventory by himself. He just is not honest enough, and he can't see straight enough to do it. He needs help. He needs counsel. He needs a sponsor. He needs a counselor to help him. Someone who's experienced in these things and these ways of life. Someone who's had experience and has had benefit of it and can help him in whom he has confidence. It doesn't necessarily have to be another area. It could be some other type of counselor. But he should have someone help him. And the first step suggests that there is someone helping him because it says in that first step we admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. So we
go on record. He faced the issue, like this little girl did this morning, the talk. He faced things eventually. That's how she recovered. Now, get fair. Listen how these better worded for the extremist, the alcoholics who can't do things by half their measure. It says we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Doesn't say that we're getting ready or going to be ready, or we're going to remove some of these defects. It says we were entirely ready to have God remove, not us, but God remove all these defects. We're ready for it to do this. This is an attitude of readiness. We're waiting. So step 7 says, we humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. We didn't make a deal with him like we heard about last night, making a deal to do this. We just humbly asked him. Okay, now we have submitted ourselves, we've submitted our wills and our life to the care of God, and we've done something about it. So that's the second phase. Third phase is what I prefer to call phase of restitution. No one can start a new life without cleaning up this garbage from the old. We can't carry this stuff over with us. We can't do it. So we have to make an effort to make things right with people we've harmed. Obviously, we don't know all the people we've harmed, and we'll never be able to find them. Good many of them are gone, good many of them we don't know. But we said there we had this attitude of willingness here. So we made a list of all persons we'd harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. So some people I just didn't want to make amends to for one reason or another. Some people I had terrific resentment for, some people I was afraid of. That isn't what the program said. I had to do this. And I had a couple of real tough jobs of restitution that I had to perform. And I did it. And I can remember going to some people, and most of them said, well, that's fine, Simon, that's great. It's when I sent down this place where I made direct amends wherever possible. I went to these people, and some of the old playboys, he just go on, just leave me alone. It's all right, just do it. Good enough, I tried, and I did what I could. Other one said, that's why, boy, good luck to you. Good luck. Other one said, out. Out. Go away. I had a couple of real puppies. Anyway, it was done. So we made direct amends wherever possible, except where to do so with injured them or others. This step should be taken with the help of one sponsor, too, because in our new enthusiasm, when we come in here, we can really follow a lot of detail. A woman comes in here, and he's in here 3 months, and he can write a better book than we have. He can run a better group. He can do everything better. He's a genius. In 3 months, sometimes it don't take that long. That guy, he means all right, but he needs someone to take him through these dark passages. He can really screw himself up and a lot of other people in the process. So he needs a steady head and a steady hand to help him with that restitution. Okay, we've gone through 3 phases. Admission, submission, and restitution. Now we've got to stay clean. Let's keep it clean. Now how do we keep it clean? Someone asked me to pay special attention. The only reason I'm talking about this, someone asked me to tonight about these steps. I had something else I was going to talk about. But I'm glad I talked about it. I like to talk about this step. It's our life. You get to see it, this ninth step. We've gone through our admission, our submission, our restitution. Okay, something has happened to us. Listen very carefully now, because I don't want to start a riot like I did in the town by making this statement and people are listening while they're talking. I always say that people have, the good Lord gave us 2 ears and 1 mouth, which suggests we ought to listen twice as much as we talk. Now listen with both ears, because I don't want any misunderstanding, that we are trying to do these things, some of us, especially when we're, well, I'm not going to say that.
9 steps.
Forget them.
They're done. From now on, if we have gone through these 9 steps as I have outlined here, we never have to refer to them again except when we explain to someone, or if we get drunk again and resign from the fraternity and we have to re-enter. Then we have to begin new again. But now we've gone through these 9 steps. People say, when do I have to take these steps? And what steps can I take first? Well, what the hell is a fire?
I don't see where they mix all these up every time they print them.
It comes right down in order. Everyone has a number. Step 1, step 2, step 3, step 4, step 5, step 6, step 7, step 8, step 9. So we get through step 9 and something has happened. We're done with this stuff. We've done a lot of things. We've made our stand. We submit our will and our life to care of God. He has taken things away from us. He's removed these things for us. In this step back here, it says about humbly asking in step 7 to remove these shortcomings. The good book promises us that we ask, believing, we shall receive. So we have to assume that we're forgiven all this stuff. After it's all done, we're done. From now on, we're in new life. After 9 steps, you're in a new life. Now, here's what we do. The last phase of this is step of construction. This covers the 10th, 11th, and 12th steps. These are the steps where we construct the life, where we build, where we grow. These are the steps that keep us going, and keep us alive, and keep us serviceable, and keep us servicing, and keep us worshiping. Listen carefully to what these steps say, because these are the steps we live by. People say, when all these people give you a talk about they want to do 2 or 3 steps, they never got past the second step, or they never got past this step. What the heck are they talking about?
Here are 9 steps. If you want to belong to AA, this is the way it goes. Then something will happen. You're a different person. You feel differently. You act differently. You walk differently. Everything is different. You're a new person. I learned this thing about new persons from a chap in Akron. When I was quite new, probably 6 months old in AA, in the fellowship, and this old Joe Van Horn, he used to spend a lot of time with me. He used to somehow or other like me, I don't know why, I was about half scared of this guy all the time. He was a great big gorilla. And he always used to get me a corner after a meeting and talk to me. Bill had been put in a nut house by his family. They had probated him, and he was supposed to stay in his nut factory for the rest of his life. But Doc Smith, my sponsor, got him out of there and put him in the group. And Bill takes over to the day he dies. And Bill is a very well-kept character, and I don't know why he took such an interest in me. Probably he just liked to pick up old dogs and cats and things, and I looked like one of them, maybe. But as be that as it may, he liked me. And that was his way of touching me, I guess. So one night at a meeting, after a meeting, he got me in a corner. He says, Clarence, he says, I'm going to give you the answer to this whole ball out. He says, I'm going to give you the answer. He says, I'm going to give you something here. And I want you to read it. I want you to memorize it. I don't want you to ever forget it. But here's the answer to the whole ball of wax. So I can still see Bill, but it's just like it was yesterday. Many years ago, he took out this old beat-up billfold of his, and it was all crammed full of papers and pictures and other debris of different kinds he had in there. No money, but all kinds of stuff he had stuffed in there. He unloads this whole bunch of stuff and piles it on the table there in the library table in C. Henry's living room. He finally comes a little paper that he wanted to find, the thing he was looking for, and he handed it to me. And that was a Bible verse. This Bible verse read this. It was the 2 Corinthians, the 5th chapter, and the 17th verse. It says, therefore, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. Now, think about that. That is the answer to our problem. You tell me what it is. This change is taking place. If any man be in Christ, he's a new creature. If any man comes in here and admits and submits, makes his restitution, he's a new creature. Old things have passed away. Behold, all things have become new. This is a story. All right. We'll live on these last three steps.
Listen to them. I got off the track here a little bit, but we got another hour and a half to go.
The tenth step. It says we continue. Now, this is the first step in the construction stage. We continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. Now, isn't that a kettle of fish?
We are rummy, promptly admitting he's wrong. A rummy never admits anything. You don't either admit it's raining outside, it might involve you in something.
Here we are promptly admitting when we're wrong. This is not our nature. But it is now that we've taken those nine steps, we can do this. We couldn't have done this before. If you don't believe this, sit down at the court someday. I know none of you folks have ever been before the bar of justice because you don't look like those kind of people. You've never been pinched, you've never been up in this situation, but you ought to sit down and see what goes on in the courthouse because you're paying taxes to support this stuff and you ought to know what to do with your dough. Someday sit down and look and watch them. And you'll see, we had a judge in here this morning. He mentioned a few things about it. But this mummy, he'll walk up there, he's bleary-eyed, he's drunk, he's been out the night before that, and it's taken him a day or so to get him sober enough to get him up in front of the judge. He's gone out there, he's taken a car out, he's run into a police car, gone to a place that's when the police come out, he fights the police. Everybody's car's upside down, there's glass, everything all over the place. That's carnage. So he's charged with being drunk. You guys think you're drunk. Well, you're drinking. Think you should admit this? Not by a dreadful. After a lot of this going back and forth, he'll finally admit that he had a couple of beers. I've never in my life seen anybody get in trouble for drinking. It's only those guys that had a couple of beers. That's all. So, gee, don't ever get mixed up with anything like that. We don't admit anything, but here we are. We can do it now in this tenth step. We admit promptly. We can continue to take personal inventory. This is time to do this, preferably at night. The last thing when we lie down, go to sleep. Think about our day. I do every night. I think about what I've done. Some of the things I think about don't give me much encouragement. Some things I'm rather ashamed of. So I think about them. It comes to me, and I think about how maybe I could have done better. And perhaps I owe somebody an apology. Or at least I can probably do better tomorrow. I'll try. But if we don't sit down, if we don't lie there at night and think about this day's activity, well, I remember one thing about us. People are always looking for something big to happen. Our rummy's always got a big deal cooking somewhere, see? Well, forget it. There are very few big things ever happen to a rummy. Believe me. Count them sometimes. You can count them on the fingers of one hand. You're born. That's a pretty big event. Maybe you get an education. That's pretty good. That'd be a good event. Well, then you get married. One, two, six times. Those are big events. They're usually pretty important, at least. You might have a family. That's important. Maybe you'll inherit $1 million. I don't know any rummies that did, but I know a lot of rummies. I never met one that did. But that would be a big event if you did. Then you die. A big event. It's starting something new again. So how many big things happen to us? Every day, no matter what your situation, where you are, whether you're a housewife, whether you're a servant, such as I am, whether you're out working in a shop, or you're working in a store, in an office, whatever. Every day there are hundreds of little things to contend with. There are things we have to deal with every day. They're little things. And these associations we have with people,
Now, what's going to make it a purchase? It's the habits and the patterns we get into and form. It's going to be the difference. So, it behooves us every night to check on that day. We have very clear memories. We are experts at blocking everything, and finding excuses for us that we can justify anything. Our memories are so bad that I can't even remember my middle name sometimes when somebody asks me. We are not known for, we don't have this eloquent gift of memory. That's probably a good thing. So we should check up every night on ourselves. Not let things get away from us, because patterns can be set very easily. I know a lot about that. Step 11. This is called 11th step. The truth here. What is 11th step? Listen to this 11th step. This is a very important step. This is the middle one in our steps and our phase of construction. See this step that introduces us to a prayer life. It introduces us. It says in this step, we stop through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Let's break that down a little bit. We stop through prayer and meditation. Not just what they mean by prayer and meditation. What is prayer and what is meditation? Prayer is talking to God and meditation is listening to Him. It's just that simple. We can talk all we want to God, but if we don't listen to get the answer, what's the use of talking to Him in the first place? We might as well have a monologue. We are answering our thought, which would be better. So we stop through prayer and meditation. What are we speaking through this talking and listening to Him? Very simple. It doesn't say anything about sobriety, or it doesn't say anything that we're seeking to buy a new house, or get a new car, or get a new job, or get a new wife, or get a new husband. It doesn't say anything like this at all. Because we stop through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. What's that? The conscious contact with God. Very simple. We have to know and feel that He is here. He's right here, as close as anybody. As a good book says, close to the hand and feet. We have this conscious contact. We know He is the God. We believe it. We don't believe it with death, because we already accepted way back there before. So we're establishing this conscious contact through talking and listening to Him. This is a practice we must indulge in regularly, not just miss. This is one of the disciplines that we have to impose upon ourselves. So what are we trying to do? What are we praying for? If we're praying only for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry that out. We want to know what He wants us to do. What does He want me to do? The good book tells us He'll never require anything else that He won't give us the strength to perform. So we ask Him for the power to carry out His wishes. In other words, live on a spirit rhythm the rest of our lives. This is what we're going to do. This is what the meaning of a changed life is. All right. What does it say in the 12th step? You hear people talk about 12th step, and this is most ridiculous. Some of the things you hear about 12 stepping. You wonder what they're talking about. People come to me and they say, when are you supposed to go on 12 step work? Why, a knucklehead, read this program. It'll tell you when to go. Well, it says here, when we go, it says, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other apparatus. It didn't say that you come in here and sit down here in this group and rub elbows for a few days or a few weeks and rush out there and bring everybody into AA. We have to have something to carry out to that bird before we can do anything with him. We have to have a message to carry. And I always say this, if I have measles, I can give you measles. If I have chicken pox, I can give you chicken pox. If I don't have measles, I can't give them to you. And if I don't have chicken pox, I can't give them to you.
Likewise, if I don't have an AA message, if I don't have something in here to share with you, what am I going to give you?
Well, the 12-step tells you when should you go out and do 12-step work to record. Having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, we try to carry the message, not the alcoholic. Try to carry the message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Probably the only 3 steps we have to concern ourselves with once we have accepted this program. Very simple. They say this is a simple program. Some people say it's very hard. My friend, it is not hard. It's only hard if we make it this way. If we come into this fellowship qualified, ready, and wanting to really do something and meaning it, and we accept this program as it's outlined here, it's a pleasure. It isn't hard. If it was hard, there was none of us could make it. Because you and I, every one of us, has tried every dodge in the book to try to quit drinking at some time or other. We've been arrested, we've been fired, we've been rehired, we've been fired again, we've been kicked out of our homes, we've been kicked back in. We have been disgraced, we've been arrested, we've been everything that happened to us. And we've made all kinds of motions to try to quit drinking. Never worked until we got a change of our life. People you see around you, this is one of the great things about retreat. I get a tremendous boost out of going to retreat. I am a fortunate person in that I have been around this fellowship a long time. I do have a lot of friends, and I do get invited to go around and take part in activities pretty well all over the country. This has happened to me. I'm very fortunate. And I get to see a lot of people and meet a lot of people. And I know their hopes, and I know their aspirations. I know their fears. And I talk to them about it. I know what makes people tick in this. I know what makes people happy in this. And I know when I meet happy people in AA, I know what has made them that way. I know it's their attitude and the way they feel and the changes come over them that impels them to love. This is a program of love and service. You talk all you want about love. People are pretty vague about it. And in this fellowship, we can't be vague about love. This is a program and a way of life that requires loving specific people. Not loving everybody per se, but loving specific people and devoting ourselves to their betterment, to their health. It's a great thing. Age in AA, some people say, don't mean anything. That's a lot of hogwash. It means an awful lot. Usually the ones that say, don't get any age, and the ones that hire, that doesn't mean anything. But I'll tell you what it means. It means that you've had opportunity of meeting people, sharing with them, loving them, and being loved. Means that you have friends. You can go out and in a group of people after you're around long enough, you find someone who touched your life. And you'll find people whose life you've touched. You can't spell a chart. It means something. They say, well, the guy takes credit for this and that. It isn't a matter of taking credit for anything. I remember sitting, standing up there. See, we got another hour. I remember standing up there in Toronto. Some of you folks here, we got that get together, that big shindig up in Toronto 2 weeks ago. I looked out over this crowd. This is a midnight meeting, if you can imagine this. There were seats for 2,500 people in this hall, and there's about 400 or 500 of them standing up around the hall besides at midnight. These people have to be nuts to do this, you know. And we had a meeting that lasted until 2 o'clock in the morning. See, it's only 10 now. I looked out over this crowd,
And I saw people there who had that many, many years ago. Some of them 25, 26 years ago. Still sober. Still enjoying this way of life. Getting up there and having a great time. I see those people. There were seven of them sitting in the first few rows who I saw come in there. They've been in there that long. Right in the first few rows, there were other people started around too, had a lot of years too. So I saw those people when they came in originally, these many years ago. I knew their situation then, what their circumstances were at the time. I know what's happened to them down through these years. These things do something to you. This is one of the advantages of having years in AA. Those people inspire me. What inspiration can I get out of seeing some jughead come in here bouncing in and out like a yo-yo? I don't see the AA. It's not inspiring to me. Somebody come in. Maybe he's been bouncing around like a yo-yo, but he comes in and takes a stand for something and devotes himself to something, and his life is changed, and he serves the balance of his life. This is inspiration. It's been very nice talking to you. I hope that we all get together again. I hope you all take time next spring to visit our retreat down at Camp Monroe. You get a big kick out of that. It isn't as elaborate as this. It's a little rustic, but it's wonderful. And if you can't make that, it's all to be here next year again. Thank you very much.